Welcome to The Greek Current, a podcast by Halk and Kathimerini. I'm your host, Thanos Davelis. This week, Washington, D.C. turned its attention to Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh, once again, with a Senate Foreign Relations Committee holding a hearing on the failure to break Azerbaijan's genocidal blockade of Artsakh that has left some 120,000 Armenians on the brink of starvation. Senator Menendez, the chairman of the committee, was emphatic about the urgency of the situation in Artsakh, stating, "As we sit here today with the lives of so many people hanging in the balance, time is of the essence." Michael Rubin, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and former Pentagon official, joins me to explain how U.S. diplomacy has failed Armenians in Artsakh and look to the past for analogies that could guide policymakers looking to support the people of Artsakh and end this blockade. Michael, always great having you back on The Greek Current.
Hey, thanks for having me, Thanos.
Michael, the former International Criminal Court prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, he released an open letter last month calling Azerbaijan's blockade of Artsakh or Nagorno-Karabakh and the starvation of Armenians living there genocide. Is a genocide unfolding on our watch in the Caucasus?
I believe it is. I happen to agree with Ocampo in this. Look, the issue isn't simply the starvation. And for that, there's no excuse. And what we see in Artsakh, even if Azerbaijan says it's its own territory, well, we have a precedent there when Sudan took similar measures against Darfur. But it goes beyond simply the blockade. It goes to the demonization of the Armenians that we have seen, the denial of their cultural heritage in places where Azerbaijan has reoccupied, regained territory, the destruction of churches, the destruction of millennia-old cemeteries, and so forth. When you add all of that together, it passes the multi-part test for what constitutes a looming genocide.
I want to dig into something that you touched on just now. You know, Azerbaijani officials, they say that the international community recognizes their sovereignty over Nagorno-Karabakh. Therefore, as they argue, they have every right to use their military to subdue the region and return it to Azerbaijani control. Why is this not so cut and dry?
Well, it's not cut and dry for a number of reasons. First of all, Azerbaijan has never actually controlled Nagorno-Karabakh. It was a largely Armenian territory that Joseph Stalin, back in the 1920s, awarded to Azerbaijan as he was gerrymandering the various new stands of the Caucasus and Central Asia. But then you add a situation where, even when it was technically part of Azerbaijan, it was an autonomous oblast which was self-governing. You have a situation where, unlike, for example, Crimea, which was part of democratic Ukraine that autocratic Russia took over, we've got the opposite. We have a democratic entity, even according by Freedom House, which calls Artsakh partly free. And you have an autocracy, Azerbaijan, which ranks lower than Russia in terms of the Freedom House rankings. And so we have to ask the broader question, do you want to return a democratic entity to an autocracy? But beyond that, the Azerbaijanis are misstating what the U.S. position was in 1991. In 1991, the notion that we recognized Azerbaijani sovereignty over Nagorno-Karabakh was conditional. It was conditional on a diplomatic solution for the population that was living in Nagorno-Karabakh. And Azerbaijan, as part of this process, agreed to Minsk group diplomacy. It agreed to forswear the military option. To now say that they're going to undertake the military option, they have every right to do this, contradicts every other commitment which they had previously made upon which the U.S. notion of Azerbaijani sovereignty was based. But regardless, like I previously mentioned, you have the Sudan case. Even if Azerbaijan says that they can repossess this, it's their territory, they cannot treat a population they claim as their own in this manner. I mean, for what Ilham Aliyev is doing is what got Omar al-Bashir of Sudan indicted before the International Criminal Court.
I want to keep us on the U.S., Michael. You know, you wrote a piece this week calling out the State Department for inadvertently greenlighting war on Armenians. Has the U.S. foreign policy establishment and U.S. diplomacy, for that matter, failed the Armenians in Artsakh?
I believe very firmly that we have failed the Armenians in Artsakh. We've had a pattern where the State Department has fallen back upon its own worst instincts of both siderism and moral equivalence. So, for example, Joe Biden acknowledged or promised as a candidate and kept his promise that he would recognize the Armenian genocide. And he did, and kudos to Joe Biden for that, for recognizing historical fact like that. Maybe he'll also recognize what happened to the Greeks in Turkey, in the new Republic of Turkey as well, in the late Ottoman period. But moving forward, just 2 days later, without telling Congress, they waived Section 907 of the Freedom Support Act, and this was after Azerbaijan had launched a military assault on Nagorno-Karabakh. So that waiver was purely illegal. They're ignoring the Humanitarian Aid Corridors Act, which prohibits U.S. assistance to any country that interferes in the further provision of U.S. assistance to other territories. So by showing that Azerbaijan, that for anything we give to Armenia, anytime we praise Armenia, we're also going to give equal praise or equal concessions to Azerbaijan, it sort of green-lighted Ilham Aliyev to believe that he would face no consequence. And indeed, that's been the case, especially with Acting Assistant Secretary Yuri Kim, who can't seem to break the mold of moral equivalence. I mean, it gets to the point of parody. It's ridiculous, this notion that there could somehow be a both-siderism when you're talking about a leader who is starving a population and the population which is being starved. It's also ridiculous to call for diplomacy, just very quickly, if you have an agreement to which both leaders have agreed back in November of 2020, and that agreement is being unimplemented, specifically the Lachin Corridor, to therefore say you need more diplomacy when, instead of standing up and calling on the Azerbaijani government to actually uphold the agreements it's just recently made, kind of signals to the Azerbaijani government that whatever commitments they make, whatever diplomacy they might promise, no one's going to hold them to account for.
This week, the U.S. Senate held a hearing on Azerbaijan's blockade of Artsakh, in which Assistant Secretary of State Yuri Kim, who you brought up, was unable to answer a question from Senator Menendez on why Aliyev wouldn't comply with orders to lift the blockade. You've even made the case that the fact that this crisis has accelerated under her tenure is no coincidence. Can you expand on that?
Well, look, I mean, Yuri Kim may be an able diplomat in terms of the culture of the State Department, but she's had several errors. And what matters is she doesn't seem to recognize those errors. As the U.S. ambassador to Albania, she was the person, the go-to American person, policy person, when it came to the Freddie Bellari case, this ethnic Greek who has been targeted by the Albanian government and held in prison, not allowed to take his elected position as mayor. Largely, look, I mean, you could say it has an ethnic component. You can also say that it has an economic component because the Albanian leader, who is sort of like a Recep Tayyip Erdogan mini-me, craves that Albanian beachside property where the ethnic Greeks tend to live. At any rate, she was unable to speak with moral clarity about the need for Freddie Bellari to either be tried or to be released. And so he lingers in prison. And this had further implications when we had the West Balkans meeting, which had strategic implications vis-a-vis Ukraine. And because of this moral equivalence, because of this empowering of an illegitimate Albanian position, we actually had the Albania-Greece spat overshadow some of the Ukraine issue. Now, fast forward. When it comes to Azerbaijan, we have the same sort of moral equivalence where we're allowing something which should have been adjudicated if the United States would assume its leadership role and should have been adjudicated in Armenia's favor, and instead it's festering and getting worse. So this is a major problem, and it's reflective both of Yuri Kim's personality, but also more broadly of the culture of the State Department, not only under Secretary of State Antony Blinken, but more broadly.
When thinking about how to deal with this crisis, policymakers are undoubtedly looking to the past for lessons. You brought up Darfur as one example. Are there other historical analogies here that should inform decision makers?
Okay, well, let's just talk very quickly about the different analogies which people can put forward. Those who oppose Artsakhi or Nagorno-Karabakh's autonomy will say, what you're doing is legitimizing what Russia is doing in Donetsk or Luhansk or Crimea. Each of those is false, simply because Donetsk and Luhansk are made out of whole cloth while Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh has a millennia-old history. When it comes to Crimea, we already talked about Crimea was part of Ukraine, and you have a dictatorship trying to take a territory away from a democracy, whereas in the case of Artsakh, it is a democracy, and you have a dictatorship trying to snuff out that democracy. Perhaps the best analogy, therefore, would be to Kosovo. where, you, like with the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, you have a centuries, if not millennia-old presence. You have a dictator who is an ethnic chauvinist. Back with regard to Kosovo, it was the Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic. In Azerbaijan, of course, it's Ilham Aliyev. And then you have the international community decide, when diplomacy went nowhere because of the insincerity in the Kosovo case of Slobodan Milosevic, that there actually had to be protection, there had to be force, there had to be autonomy, and ultimately independence. So that seems to be the analogy, the case, which best fits. Now, during the Bill Clinton administration, there were assurances that Kosovo wouldn't set a precedent. It was a one-off situation. But you know what? Everything in international relations sets a precedent. And in this case, the precedent couldn't be clearer.
Given this precedent, then, of Kosovo, what should Western support for the people of Artsakh look like?
Well, first of all, the blockade needs to be lifted, and there's two ways to do this. Number one is to insist on Lachin. Lachin is what is listed in the 2020 ceasefire declaration to which Ilham Aliyev acquiesced, agreed. Now, you have that. You could also have airlifts and other supply. If U.S. diplomats based in Armenia are not allowed to go, then certainly you should have witnesses go from the U.S. embassy in Baku, Azerbaijan. You know, genocide happens best in the dark. It doesn't happen when diplomats are at the Lachin corridor paying attention. USAID has been stonewalling Senator Menendez and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Samantha Power, given her own rise to power based on her book, A Problem from Hell, which was about the American response to genocide, should have USAID trucks there ready to roll with various witnesses facing down the Azerbaijanis who are trying to block this. You could also stop offering American assistance to Azerbaijan. You know, the United States, this is the same thing with Turkey. We often talk in policy circles about how sanctions aren't working, but you know, we've never really tried. The only time we've tried when it came to Turkey, and very minor sanctions at that, was with regard to, under President Trump, the steel tariffs to help compel the release of Pastor Andrew Brunson, and that worked wonderfully. If we actually show some backbone, then you know what? Ilham Aliyev might recognize that the policy which he is now pursuing isn't the policy which is going to bring victory to him. He wants to appear strong. He's appearing strong at our expense and at the expense of the people of Artsakh. If he's not able to appear strong, it will be amazing how quickly he will change his policies. And also, if I can just give some last analogies very, very quickly, Thanos, people will say, well, Nagorno-Karabakh or Armenia, they're too pro-Russian. And in the past, to some extent, that was true. But the analogies which I would actually bring up would be Egypt in the 1970s during the Cold War, when it was a Soviet proxy and Henry Kissinger managed to flip it. Or more recently, we have the case of Cyprus. Cyprus, for many years, was oriented perhaps a little bit too closely for U.S. comfort towards Russia. And Cyprus made a decision that it wanted to be firmly in the West, and the United States helped it make that transition. We're doing the same thing with India now, helping it move from a more pro-Russian camp to a more pro-Western camp. So why would, as some of the people at, for example, Hudson Institute counsel, why would we simply dismiss the case of Armenia and say, oh, they're too pro-Russian, rather than listen to them trying to change camps and actually give them support to change from the more pro-Russian camp into the more pro-American camp, the pro-Western camp, just as Cyprus has done? And this is the analogy to which we should be most paying attention.
Michael, always great speaking with you. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Thanos.
In other news, Cyprus's president said Thursday that joint military maneuvers with three other European Union member states underway in the Eastern Mediterranean underscore the bloc's readiness to ensure security and stability in the region. President Nikos Christodoulidis said the drill with France, Italy, and Greece is of particular geostrategic significance for the 27-member bloc and others, including the United States. Christodoulidis said his government is putting a special emphasis on upgrading the island's military installations in order to take full advantage of its geographical location at the southern-easternmost corner of Europe and close to the Middle East and Africa. The five-day drill kicked off on Monday. Finally, the Biden administration on Thursday imposed sanctions on five Turkish companies and a Turkish national, accusing them of helping Russia evade sanctions and supporting Moscow in its war against Ukraine. The designations target shipping and trade companies accused of helping repair sanctioned vessels tied to Russia's defense ministry and helping the transfer of dual-use goods. It is part of a bigger package of measures hitting Russia with sanctions on more than 150 targets. Multiple senior U.S. officials have traveled to Turkey since Russia's invasion of Ukraine as part of a pressure campaign to prevent any Turkish companies from helping Russia circumvent U.S. curbs. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.